Everybody, this is Dwayne Johnson, and I'm here to tell you about a new documentary podcast series titled What Really Happened, narrated by award-winning documentary filmmaker Andrew Jenks in coordination with our company, Seven Bucks Productions.
Muhammad Ali saved a man from committing suicide.
I got the whole world.
In 2007, Britney Spears' life became a train wreck.
Next thing I knew, all her hair was off.
Was Michael Jordan pushed out of basketball because of his gambling problem?
You know, I'm doing fine. I'm strong mentally, I'm strong physically.
Did any of these happen the way we were told? I'm Andrew Jenks, a documentary filmmaker, and along with executive producers Dwayne Johnson and Danny Garcia, I go on a rogue investigation.
This series will look deep into the unknown sides of historic news stories and then ask, what really happened?
You can subscribe and listen to What Really Happened now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
This is the Vertical Podcast. Hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news.
To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road,
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
Joining me on the podcast this week, basketball Hall of Famer, former Sports Illustrated writer. I don't even know how many books this is for him. I guess we'll have to ask. But his latest is terrific. It's called Golden Days, West Lakers, Steph's Warriors, and the California Dreamers Who Reinvented Basketball. He's Jack McCallum. What's happening, Jack?
How you doing, Chris? Honored to be on with you.
Don't you miss the, what was it like, you know, the 3.5 weeks we worked together at SI where our paths crossed?
It was longer than that. It might have seemed brief, but I knew you when. I knew you before you had 500 million Twitter followers and everything. So.
You know what I've always wanted to ask you was, would you have wanted Twitter to be around when you were covering it extensively in like the 90s and even in the 80s?
Absolutely not. I mean, the only reason when I went back, I started to do the Dream Team book in 2012, and when I started research for it, you know, this was the most sort of anticipated, glorified team there ever was. But as I put in the book, the written record of them, you know, was not very large. I mean, could you imagine if there were a social media following Barkley around the Ramblas in Barcelona? There would have, I mean, every night there would have been, you know, 2 million tweets about it. So there was sort of, when I was covering the league in the beginning, there was just more original stuff that you could get. I mean, it's very, very hard now, as I found out with the Warriors, it's very, very hard because of social media to pick up the little nuggets of information that used to really comprise the kind of stories you did for Sports Illustrated.
After, you know, doing this book and really digging into some of the players from those early 70s teams, if you could give Twitter during that time to one of those guys on that team, who would you like to have, you know, followed on Twitter if you could?
Well, there's no doubt who it would not have been, the central character in my book, Jerry West. Jerry would have been, well, everything's just fine. You know, if there was an off-the-record Twitter account, you know, Jerry would have been really good. There's absolutely no question the guy you would have needed to follow was Wilt Chamberlain. You know, Wilt was, when I started researching the book during the 71-72 season, Wilt was building this home in the Santa Monica Hills, the accounts of which are sort of like sound like when the slaves built the pyramids. You know, we were carrying 230,000 crates of marble over the mountains. Well, Wilt was building this house, and I started writing about the house and this incredible housewarming party that he had during the season. He found time between two games against expansion teams to have his housewarming party, during which he invited, you know, half of Los Angeles. And I'm writing it, and I'm going, well, you know, it's not a book about Wilt's, it's not a book about Wilt's home. So I kind of got it back down to 2 pages. But if there was anybody who would have been great, it would have been Wilt Chamberlain. And unfortunately, Wilt died in 1999. Kind of right before the social media age.
You had written before for SI about Wilt, but you know, when when you started researching this book, how much more did you learn? I mean, was there something even more interesting that you learned about Wilt in sort of studying for this?
I guess, you know, I started getting into, you know, basketball, as you know, is always, it's always best defined kind of by rivalries, you know, Bird Magic and Michael and the Pistons. And the original rivalry, everybody knew this, of course, was Russell and Wilt. I mean, and Jerry West and Oscar Robertson were two of the other ones. But Russell and Wilt kind of defined, you know, the early part of the NBA throughout the 1960s. And to research that, to see their relationship kind of ebb and flow, I had sort of remembered this. I mean, unlike you, I'm old enough to have seen Wilt play live, but I had forgotten a lot of the source of the tension between Wilt and Russell. And it turned out, you know, toward the mid-60s, later 60s, when athlete activism sort of came along with Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown, well, Bill Russell kind of joined them. They were the magic troika of athlete activism. Wilt, meanwhile, decided to endorse Richard Milhouse Nixon. So you had Wilt became the ultimate Republican. And whether or not he truly believed it or it was just Wilt kind of being a contrarian, it was interesting to me to kind of dig into that, the political relationship back then. And once again, you could have written a whole book about that, and it's just kind of a subtext. But those 60s and 70s era with those characters, when not everything was known to the public, remains fascinating.
Do you believe that Wilt in his prime would have been effective in today's NBA?
I always, my bailout answer to that question always is, I think that any player who was a great player in any era would figure out a way to be a great player in this era. However, it's a little more nuanced than that in the case of Wilt. The first thing is that no matter what the old timers will tell you about defenses, they were not sophisticated. I mean, the guys that were honest with you will tell you they basically played Wilt man-to-man. In fact, one of the astonishing things I unearthed during that season was when the Lakers were playing the game that ended up being the streak ender against the Milwaukee Bucks. Sharman was talking about, Bill Sharman, the coach of the Lakers, was talking about, you know, I think we're going to have our guards dig at Kareem a little bit when he gets the ball in the pivot. Well, no kidding. You know, I mean, today that's exhibit A. There's like 27 ways you're digging at the center, you know. So it was basically a mano type of league. It was in a strange way rougher. You know, you could put both hands on a guy, you could arm bar a guy. So there was a physicality to it, but there was not the sophistication. So Wilt, by and large, established a lot of those numbers by going against one player. Having said that, Wilt's physical prowess remains one of the most incredible athletes in the history of any sport. Wilt would have been a great player in this era. He just wouldn't have scored as much. He would have had to have gone to a passing game much earlier because he would have been double and triple teamed.
I want to get into West and the genesis of this book, but you know the relationship between West and Wilt Chamberlain, two different guys in terms of where they came from. How would you characterize their relationship?
Well, Jerry says it was, I think any relationship with Wilt was kind of by definition, and I'm talking like I know him, I don't, but just from the extensive research, what I know about him, it was a little bit fraught. I mean, Wilt was in charge of the team, and that when he came to the Lakers in 1968, that became sort of one of the sticking points because Elgin Baylor at that point was the elder statesman, was the boss, was the captain, the guy that Jerry never was that. You know, Jerry was the classic lead by example type of guy. So any relationship with Wilt, he tended to dominate the relationship. With Jerry, that was fine, because Jerry didn't really push back much against that. And I think West, one of the things he really respected about Wilt was the way he changed his game in 71-72. However, later on in the career, after their championship season and the season that I write about in the book, you know, Wilt came out with his own autobiography, during which he took a couple shots at Jerry West. And one of them being, hey, Jerry never spoke out. You know, Jerry never, you know, he was always played the good guy act, the little boy act. And I think Jerry reacted to that. He didn't like it, of course, but I think there was a measure of truth in that. And I think as time went on, particularly now when you talk to Jerry, I think those days when he didn't speak out, when he was not a labor leader the way that Oscar Robertson was, I think that affected Jerry a little bit and caused him to speak out a little more when he got with the Warriors, who, as you know, speak out on pretty much everything.
Yeah.
So Wilt was one of the Wilt would have fit in well with those Warriors, whether or not he would have had a political position in opposition to Steph Curry. That would have been very interesting if he would have been a Republican on the Warriors Democrat team.
So it's a fascinating idea for a book, Jack, and it's written through the lens of Jerry West, obviously, who was part of that early 70s Laker team and, of course, worked for the Warriors this past season. Just take me through kind of the idea of it, how this all came about and how the idea for this book came together.
Well, I was listening to a Doors album. We were having an email exchange about groups that we did not like, but we liked one song. And I liked L.A. Woman by the Doors. You're too young to remember L.A. Woman by the Doors.
I've heard it.
Yeah, I know. Google it sometime. YouTube it. It's a great song.
I Bing things.
Yeah, okay. See, you're even a step ahead of me there. And it came on, and I said, hey, what year was that? It was 1971. Well, that's the year I started working as a sports writer. A couple other things happened. I started researching things about Los Angeles. It was the 2 years after the Charles Manson murders, and although they were going on trial, there was some racial tension in the city. It was the year the Lakers won the 33 straight games. I loved Jerry West. I was, covered him extensively in the 80s and 90s when he was a general manager. And I thought, wow, that'd be a great book to kind of go back and revisit that team. The idea of winning 33 straight games, the way they used to travel back then, was absurd. Well, I suggested the proposal, but at the same time, the Warriors, this was back the season before last, were on their long winning streak. And the publisher suggested, could we somehow bring in a newer element? In other words, a nice way of telling me, that skews a little old, Jack, skews a little old. And they kind of said, it'd be this kind of book for just a Lakers book, but if you put the Warriors to it, maybe we can make it a little bigger, a little more lucrative. I said, great idea. Why didn't I think of that? But actually, then I was the one that said, Jerry West suddenly came upon me as this link between the two teams. So it turned into a book kind of about two eras through the kind of continuing lens of one guy who's been basically relevant in this league since 1960. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about it, the guy's almost had 60 years of relevance in the NBA. It remains to be seen, what's going to go on with the Clippers, but that was Jerry at that point.
And you were, how I first discovered you were working on this book, actually, you were the guy that broke the news that Jerry West was leaving Golden State to go work. I don't know if you reported he was going to the Clippers, but that he was leaving Golden State. I think you did say going to the Clippers, right?
Yeah, well, Jerry had, I had interviewed him many times during the season. Incidentally, every time I sat down with Jerry, I would go into this long preamble about the book I was doing. I'm still not even sure Jerry knows what it was about. I would get 10 seconds into it, and Jerry would just, would start talking, and I'd turn the tape recorder on, and 2 hours later, I'd have, some gold. The interview might have been all over the place. But about 6 weeks before the playoffs began, Jerry told, he just kind of stunned me, that he told me off the record that he was probably going to leave, and that the Warriors were doing some things that he didn't like, and I kept trying to, I said, geez, well, can you tell me now, keep it off the record? Then he finally told me that they had cut his salary, but he didn't want me to write it, and I kept dreading that it was going to appear in the Golden State area newspapers at any point, because that team is covered, as pretty well, and there's some great journalists out there. But and then when it got time to, I just said, look, I have to deal with the story. I know it. And I was able to get the information from another source. And I finally told Jerry, look, I'm writing that you're leaving, and I'm going to put it on, sportsillustrated.com, because I've known this for a while. And Jerry just, I guess he was kind of okay with it. And the news kind of got out after that. And then I expanded on it a little bit in the book.
How you mentioned that he has been able to stay relevant, whether as a player or an executive, really since the 60s. That's a rare skill, to be able to just translate eras in the way that Jerry has. When you think back of all the conversations you've had with him, what do you attribute that to? How do you explain his ability to continue to be, even now with the Clippers, such a valued basketball mind?
You know, I was thinking about this. His last season was 1974, and he didn't even play much of that. I think that's correct. So now you're talking about some 40. Since that time, he has basically been an executive. You know, he was a scout. He was sort of a half coach with Riley. Then he became general manager. Then he became the Mahaff in Memphis. Then he went back. He's a consultant. He's on the executive board. He's a part owner. So, yet somehow, this guy always comes across as player. I mean, David West told me something very interesting. Normally, when the old guys come down, you know, and start to tell you something about your game, it was always, well, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, we did it this way. There was a whole spate of that during the Warriors season, as you remember, you know, Oscar and all these guys. Oh, hell, we could stop them. What are you talking about? You know, we could stop Curry. Jerry, for some reason, never does that. He never goes back and talks about what it was for him. David West told me that every time he came down, he gave him some little bit of information that remained relevant without shoving it down his throat. He did the same thing with Draymond Green. He did the same thing with Klay Thompson. He didn't mess around with Steph very much. He's not going to change Steph's shooting stroke. But every time he imparted some knowledge to those guys, it always sounded like something not of the old, we did it better in our day. And really, I think that's the key to why he's become relevant. He makes the moves he has to as a general manager. He's management all the way, but he communicates with players in a way that very few team executives, and in some cases coaches, have been able to do.
When you were interviewing people for this book, like guys that played or coached in that era of the early 70s and the 60s, did you find that to be commonplace where they would be critical of the Warriors? I mean, how did they speak of the Warriors? Because you're right, in the last 2 years, whether it's Oscar Robertson or others, there just seems to be a bullseye on the Warriors, maybe because of the way they play or how they act.
There's no question. You know, I found it a little bit. It was kind of comparable to when I did the Suns book a decade ago. You know, when you do something different, there is always a resistance to it. You know, guys like Charles Barkley and all them. Now, the Warriors, the problem with criticizing the Warriors is that they've been so successful. And somebody talked about, you know, the pieces that they have around them on the court. Well, the amazing thing about the Warriors is they play defense also. You know, you got these guys out there, and they somehow, the problem with putting five sort of guys that know how to space the floor and are unselfish and can shoot from distance and run the floor, yeah, okay, that sounds like a good idea, but they usually can't play defense. But the Warriors play defense, and that has kind of confounded the old guys that wanted to criticize them. The most interesting guy probably was Rick Barry, because I'm sure you either know Rick or have come across him.
Yeah.
Rick can pretty much find fault with anything.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of find some fault with the Warriors. But even he had to say that he, DVRs them every game. He sees them live. He loves watching Steph Curry play, even when he throws the damn ball away. So I think probably, ultimately, they've probably got more converts than they have critics. Simply because you'd have to be an idiot not to appreciate the way the Warriors play the game and defend.
Sure. Who did you find surprisingly insightful or surprisingly useful as you were reporting this book?
Well, it's not surprising that Steve Kerr.
Yeah.
I mean, here's what it was with Steve. Steve, in a way, it was a strange season to be with him because every time, as you know, I'm getting up there in years. So I would go to Steve, and Steve's much younger than I am. However, he was going through these incredible physical problems. And every time I would talk to him, I could see him, you know, wrenching his neck. And I know everybody wrote a lot about it, and it certainly wasn't an untold theme, but boy, what he went through, you know, the last 2 years to get through those seasons. So I would sit down with Steve and I'd say, man, I feel bad. I know you just want to go and lie down. I said, so we talked for 10 minutes about politics and we talked for 10 minutes about the team, usually kind of almost off the record. Like I'd say to Steve, tell me what's going on, you know. And in answer to your question, besides Steve, who is not surprising, I think a lot of times, I'm sure you've found this out, Chris, is the guys who have been around the league who may not be the central characters on a team. And on the Warriors, two of those guys are Sean Livingston and David West. And I found them, every time you talk to them, really insightful, really smart, really plugged into the things that make a team really gel.
The coach is instrumental in team success. And, you know, Steve Kerr deflects a lot of that. But there's no doubt that team is what it is, in part because of the influence of Steve Kerr. On the flip side of it, you know, Bill Sharman passed away in 2013. But, you know, when you were kind of learning more about him, and I'm sure you picked up things about him along the way as an SI guy, what was his most significant impact on that Lakers team?
Well, he came into what you have to understand about the Lakers was that despite the fact that everybody loved Jerry West and everybody loved Elgin Baylor and everybody knew Wilt Chamberlain, they were losers. That was their thing. They had lost six times in the finals to that team in Boston. The name escapes me. What team is that up there?
They wear green.
They wear green.
Shamrocks.
You know, Shamrocks. Irish, Shamrocks, you know, yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah. Six times in the finals. I mean, could you imagine how Jerry West would have gotten beaten up on social media?
Oh, man.
Six times. Then they proceeded to lose to the Knicks in 1970. That's 0-7 in the finals. Then they lost to the Bucks in the next year in the semifinals. So this Jerry West is 0-8 going into the season. So Bill Sharman, an ex-Celtic, by the way, comes in.
Bob Cousy's partner.
Exactly, yeah. Bob Cousy's partner. And, you know, Jerry said it never really bothered him that he was an ex-Celtic, but Pat Riley said, that's bullshit. You know, Jerry was apoplectic over the fact that ex-Celtic was coaching him. Not only that, Bill Sharman brings in Casey Jones, you know, who was a voracious, in-your-face defender and also a Celtic. Mm-hmm. So they got two Celtic guys. I think here's what people liked about Bill Sharman. He was very much an early Steve Kerr. He was very decisive in a couple of things he did, which I'll talk about in a second. But he did it in a I'm-not-the-whole-show manner. He did it in a kind of democratic manner. Three of the things he did was, Jerry West, you got the ball, you're going to be a point guard. It was never sure before what Jerry was. He was like a G in the scorebook, you know. Jerry, you got the ball. Gail Goodrich, you do not have the ball. Jerry's going to have to find you. Number two, Wilt, you're going to become a defender. You're going to become a passer. There's going to become games when you only take one or two shots. You're going to make outlet passes on the break. And number three, we're going to play fast. We have to run. The ball is not going to stick. And to that end, you know, nine games into the season, there was a meeting, and he either told Elgin Baylor he was going to the bench, or he said, Elgin, we want you to retire, but we're still going to pay you. It's as if we cut you, and we're going to put Jim McMillan in the lineup. And I think one of the great bittersweet things about in NBA history is that Elgin Baylor, one of the legends of the game, retired on the very day that the Lakers began their 33-game winning streak. So Bill was very decisive, and he also started a shoot-around. You know, Wilt never got to bed before 5 o'clock in the morning. And now Bill Sharman's saying, yeah, we want you to be at the gym at 9 or 10. And this was a job of epic salesmanship. You know, and it's the old saying, as you know, as long as we're winning, as long as we're winning, it's going to work. And fortunately for Sharman and West and Wilt and the Lakers, it was a winning season.
I want to get to a couple things about that team, but you mentioned the losses that piled up for Jerry West, and you're right. I mean, if he was playing, I mean, we know when LeBron lost, how many he lost, I mean, what his record is in the finals. Jerry West would be, you know, probably pilloried if he played in the social media age. But how did Jerry handle losing on that big stage as often as he did?
Well, not very well. Yeah. And it kind of defined Jerry's. There's part of Jerry, I didn't want to get overly psychoanalytical about him, but I think he has partly a, maybe guilt is too strong a word, about being as celebrated as he is, because you would be talking to him and the number of times he returned to that subject of losing. You know, and he told me this one, give me this metaphor that, I mean, he's talking one night, he goes, Elgin and I were like two kids. We're outside and we're looking at this Christmas gift inside, and there's only a window pane separating us. And it was like Christmas Day, but we couldn't quite get in to get the present. I'm going, holy smoke, you know, that's some heavy metaphorical stuff going on. And now you got to understand, this is 50 years ago, you know. So Jerry did not let that go. He had a number of times during that run when he said he was going to, thought he might retire, particularly after 1969 finals, when they were clearly, Russell was on fumes. It was his last season. They had game 7 was at the Forum in L.A., and they blew that game. And Jerry very nearly quit after that game. But what always brought him back, you know, I end the book with him talking about kind of reflecting on what basketball meant to him. I mean, he was a lonely kid. He had an abusive father psychologically, if not sometimes physically. He had a lonely childhood. He had a withdrawn, introverted personality, but he found basketball. And it took him to places that he never thought he could go. So I think that he always remembered that. What in the hell else am I going to do if I don't play this game? And if anybody understood that, Jerry West did.
You know, one of the defining characteristics of this Warriors team in this era is that they're all, they get along really well. And there are no real egos, at least not that present themselves kind of on the court. There's a lot of personalities in that. In that Lakers team with West and Elgin Baylor and Wilt, among others. I mean, how was the dynamic in that locker room? How important was it for that team to be successful?
Completely different. I mean, you actually hit on it. And I think one of the things that West, a couple times in the book and many other times that I didn't mention, West would marvel at how the Warriors were doing this with this kind of chemistry, which was started, you know, it comes pretty much from Steve Kerr, but also from Bob Myers, the general manager. It's the kind of franchise that Joe Lacob and Peter Guber want, but what the hell, it's the kind of franchise everybody wants. You know, you have to, you know, hey, we get along, you know, everybody's on the same page. Starts with Kerr, goes through Bob Myers, Steph Curry, you know, plugs into that just as Tim Duncan did. So that's really a real thing with the Warriors. It's not, you know, it's not something made up. It's very, very important to that team. The 71-72 Lakers, not so much. I mean, even Jerry said, kind of islands unto themselves. They were veteran players, first of all. I mean, Jerry came into the league in 1960 season. Wilt came in a year before that. So Elgin Baylor had come in 2 years before that. So this was a team defined by kind of grizzled veterans, you know. And it had a very much of a, let's just get it done on the court. You know, I mean, I think Jerry and Wilt went out to dinner, you know, a couple times. They respected each other on the court, don't get me wrong, but it was a completely different dynamic in terms of how they handled themselves and the whole team unity feeling, which, but then again, I think the Warriors are almost pretty unusual with that. I mean, I hung around the Suns, you know, during the 7 seconds or less. They were, you know, fine. They got along fine. They were together, but they were a little bit more of an island team also. I think the way the Warriors approach this thing is really unusual, and I think it has been part of the reason they've been successful.
And you got to Riley for this book, and it's, I guess, almost even overlooked that he was a big part of that team. How was he when you were talking about those Laker teams?
Well, Riley was probably, you know, the most surprising, in a good way, interview that I had. I mean, as you might know, you know, he's a little elusive these days.
Yeah.
He was great in the 80s, by the way. I mean, when Pat was coaching the Lakers, if you would get some time with Pat, he would always come away with something. I mean, he was very smart, and he was candid in his own way. He was also canny. He liked to send some messages through the media. But I said, Pat, I'd like to come down and talk to you about this. And, you know, took a while, but I was in his office for 2 hours. And I think I was just lucky. And the reason was, is that Laker team and his association with the Lakers, and the fact that he ended up on that team on the basis of a $100 waiver wire that he got picked up from Portland. He was an also-ran. He comes to the Lakers. He plays on a team that wins 33 straight games. He meets Jerry West. He goes back. He plays in Phoenix, but he comes back as Chick Hearn's backup announcer. He knows enough basketball. He's obviously smart that he becomes coach of the team. And the next thing you know, it's Pat Riley of the Showtime Lakers. And one of the things he told me, I'll never forget this, he's sitting in his chair and he goes, if I don't get picked up by the Lakers, if I don't, you know, play a role on that team, if I don't become coach of that team, he waves his hand around his palatial Miami office. He goes, who knows, maybe none of this. And his respect for Jerry West, with whom he had some you know, had some tough moments when Jerry was the GM and Pat was coach.
Yeah.
That respect is kind of undying.
Yeah. How would you describe that relationship over the years?
Well, they're two very strong personalities, and it will be interesting to see. Take Steve Kerr and, you know Steve Kerr and Bob Myers, and
sure,
you've certainly seen their relationship and how they're 1 and 1A, and whether they have disagreements, I'm sure they do, but they sound like versions of the same person almost, you know, and it's part of that Warriors unity. And let me emphasize, I don't think it's an act. I don't think they're putting anything on. However, as time goes on, the Warriors don't win. Things start to happen. They disagree on some personnel moves, which is probably going to be inevitable. How is it then? And I think Pat and Jerry started from a strange place. They started as teammates. You know, that's a very, very different thing when you start, you know, from somewhere else, when you start as coach and when you start as coach as general manager. You know, Pat asked to come back to the Lakers, and when Jerry was coach, and he wanted a tryout. And Jerry said no, said, you know, you're too injured. And Pat said that Jerry told him, well, you know too much about me, you know, because referring back to when they were teammates. But Pat said Jerry was just trying to protect me from myself. He knew that my career was over even if I didn't. So when he came back, he comes back as announcer, and he comes back and they're co-coaches for a while. Well, then Jerry goes into the front office, and Pat Riley told me it was kind of astonished that one of the things that happened in the 80s as the Showtime Lakers started piling up championships and, you know, the acclaim of the basketball world, Pat says, I took too much of the credit. I had the endorsement deals. I had the speaking engagements. I had the books. And he said, I really regret doing that. And that led to kind of a, you know, a fissure in the relationship between Jerry and him. And eventually they patched it back up, but they had some rough moments, but perhaps that was inevitable for two such strong personalities.
And Elgin Baylor is a big part of all this. And he's a guy, Jack, that as you know, I mean, kind of went underground after 2010, 2011, and the end of his tenure with the Clippers. How did you find him when it came to talking about all about the past and the team, that Laker team?
Well, it was very early when I was doing this. I didn't even know what the Warriors aspect of the book hadn't even come in. And I had talked to Jerry, and I was figuring I was just doing this book about Los Angeles and the Lakers of that era. And, boy, I really wanted to talk to Elgin. And he didn't – and, you know, I had known him a little bit, but I felt kind of guilty myself because when Elgin went to the Clippers, you know, he had all those years – under Sterling, and all you know, it's not the Clippers of now, let's, you know, emphasize that, all you ever wrote about the Clippers was negative. You know, that was the only, there was no positive association. And Elgin, rightly or wrongly, got sucked into that. You know, Elgin doesn't know what he's doing. Elgin wears bad sweaters. You know, Elgin just takes, you know, just takes all this abuse from the worst person in the history of sports, you know, Donald Sterling. So finally, Elgin says, okay, and I go up to his house in the Hollywood Hills and talk to him a long time. His wife sat in, but that was okay. You know, she had helped broker the interview, I think. And Elgin was very, to the extent that he can be, Elgin was very candid. I mean, Elgin is kind of a jokey guy. You'll get to a point with him. And I said to him, well, why don't you have a statue in front of the Staples Center? I mean, when they started building statues of the Lakers, you could argue Elgin Baylor would be the first one that put up. You know, he was the guy that made them when they came to Los Angeles. And Elgin would go, well, I regret it a little bit, but what do I want birds messing up my statue for? You know, he always went so far and then had kind of a jokey aspect to it. And I just can't get quite to the bottom of why the Lakers have not shown him more respect. Jerry Buss, when the idea of the statues came, just didn't, you know, Elgin, they were originally going to put one up of Elgin and Jerry. That was one of the ideas, but that never went anywhere. And Elgin just never got kind of the due that he deserves. His wife knows it, but Elgin just isn't the kind of guy to bang his fist in the air and talk about it.
I could ask you specifics about everybody you've covered in this book. There's so many good stories that are in it. But, you know, you've written a number of books and certainly countless magazine-type stories that are filled with just hilarious anecdotes. When you were reporting this this book, what was the story that you were told that just that made you laugh, that made you just kind of, that you even still think of now that is as being just incredible?
I can't get out of my head. You've come across Bill Burtka, the Lakers scout. You know, Bill is
still around.
Yeah, Bill is still around. Bill was, put it this way, Bill was a scout, you know, on that Los Angeles Lakers team, like back in the late 60s. And Bill wanted to be coach of the team when they named Charmin. And then he wanted to be the assistant when they named Casey Jones. But he just kept, you know, he was finally made a second assistant. He went on to coach in New Orleans for a while before coming back to the Lakers. Anyway, what I can never get this out of my head. He told me very early that Jack Kent Cook, who was the person that had bought the Canadian multimillionaire who bought the Lakers in the mid-60s, created the Forum, which he insisted be called the Fabulous Forum. He was the one that kind of, before Jerry Buss, he was the one that kind of ushered in the idea of the Showplace Arena and the Showplace team. That's a credit to Jack Kent Cook. But he was so cheap that Burtka said he refused to buy a new film projector for the team. And when Sharmwood would run game films, Bill had to sit by it with a pencil and hold the spool of the reel in place. And I'm, you know, I started thinking about the way the NBA is now. You know, I mean, there's the budgets, there's $2 million food budgets for the players to eat, you know, at the arena and the practice facility. And here is a team that won a championship and had immortal players on it that couldn't get themselves a new film projector.
How involved were owners back in those days? I mean, nowadays you've got some owners that meddle, you know, I don't want to say Cuban does, but Cuban's very involved. Robert Sarver certainly is very involved. But the other side of it's like Peter Holt, who just sort of backs off and lets his basketball guys do their thing in today's game. In the with those Lakers team, how involved was the owner with that group?
Well, he was pretty involved in that. He was kind of a Jack Kent Cook was a big, and once again, these are just stories. I didn't know Jack Kent Cook, but he was very much of a ceremonial type of guy. And Jerry West told me that, you know, Jack would come into his office and he would dread when he would hear, "Jerry West, please report to my office." You know, he was a very sort of formal guy, actually wore ascots. I mean, how many people actually wear ascots? And I don't think he didn't come down and tell Bill Sharman, you know, I think we should use a little, you know, press a little bit more. He certainly never pretended to do that. But he very much got involved with ceremonies after the Lakers had beaten the all-time NBA streak of, I can't remember, it was 21 or 22 games at the time on their way to 33. Jack Kent Cook decided that they would have a giant ceremony at the gym that night, and they're all going, "What the hell are we celebrating? You know, we got a whole season left to play yet, you know?" And they had, you know, plaques were, you know, after the game, and plaques were given out to Jack Kent Cook. And if you ever have a chance, you have to go on and get the YouTube ceremony of it. I mean, Jack Kent Cook sounds like he's introducing a game show or something throughout this ceremony. It's the strangest thing. So I don't think he wasn't Mark Cuban. You know, he wasn't there in the team timeout huddle or anything like that. But he very much wanted everyone to know that this was Jack Kent Cook's team. And right after the season ended, the day after they won the championship, they had a dinner at the Forum when the Lakers essentially broke up because Cook had wanted Bill Sharman's playoff share to come out of the players' money. And can you imagine that today?
Yeah.
And well, first of all, it's negotiated by the CBA, I imagine. But and then told the and the players said, "Well, that's, you know, ridiculous, but we love Bill so much, we'll do it." And then Jack Kent Cook started the story that the players refused. So the story kind of came out: players refused to give Sharman their playoff share. And if there's one thing that united the team, it was probably by the time that Jack Kent Cook was finished, their enmity for Jack Kent Cook was a unifying force.
I don't think taking the money out of the playoff share would fly in today's game.
You think not? Probably
no,
not. Probably
I,
not.
I think that would go poorly. I want to ask you a couple of questions more contemporary to tap your basketball knowledge on a couple of guys you've covered extensively that have been in the news here. First is, you're one of the only people, in fact, you might be the only person to write a legitimate profile in Greg Popovich, even though, as we read back in the day, he's not very cooperative when it comes to that stuff. I'm curious your opinion on Pop being so politically active. You mentioned the Warriors and how they're outspoken on a variety of topics. I mean, Pop has been incredibly proactive criticizing Donald Trump. You know, what have you made of that?
Yeah, I tell you the truth, Chris, I was surprised at that myself. I mean, Dave Zirin, the great, you know, writer for The Nation, you know, Pop is called, if anybody who's tried, and I have tried, and I've once in a while succeeded in getting a return call from Pop, but it doesn't happen all that often. Pop calling him himself, you know, to complain about Trump. I think, and I went out during the time I was researching the book, I went out to talk to Pop because Steve Kerr had played for Pop, and he's always a good person to talk to. And he was great. I mean, you know, he really gave me a lot of good stuff about Jerry West and a lot of good stuff about the way the Warriors play the game. Before that, you know, we went into 15 minutes off. off the record about Donald Trump. And I guess considering what Pop says now, I tell this, we sit down on the bench, and I guess, I don't know whether I brought up Trump or he did, and Pop goes, I can't tell all the adjective, but he's a sixth grader. He's a sixth grader. A sixth grader is a president of our country. And I can relate it to is that Pop told me something very interesting when I was doing that profile. Mm. He said, I'm not conservative. I'm not right wing. I'm not military. What my teams have is discipline. That's different. Discipline is different from being militaristic or having conservative political values. Discipline is what you, or even being authoritarian. Discipline is what you have when you have a franchise that's together, when you have a team, when you have people pushing together. And my guess is, I have not talked about him that directly outside of that one day. My guess is that he looks at Donald Trump and the way he runs his organization, which happens to be the United States of America, and does not see that kind of discipline, and it just drives him out of his mind. And it's great in a way. I mean, the Pop show is just incredible because yeah. He's getting increasingly like that, the guy on the mountain screaming against the tides and the coming wind, you know. But I love it.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, you seeing kind of Phoenix, the team that you wrote about some 10 years ago with D'Antoni in the book 7 Seconds or Less. They've just completely devolved into kind of a hot mess out there. And I think people have wondered, and I've even speculated in print, that Steve Nash could come back in some kind of role with the team. You know Nash, and obviously he's doing some work as a player development coach up in Golden State. Do you think he has either the temperament or the skills to be either a coach or a basketball executive? And do you think that he could work for Robert Sarver as an exec?
I think if Steve, first of all, I also spent some time with Steve for this book, since mm-hmm. he, as you mentioned, he was a player development. I've never seen a person more content with his life, by the way, right now. Steve gets up, he takes tennis lessons. You know, I think we're probably going to see him, you know, when he gets to be that age, he'll probably be the over 50, you know, Western regional champion or something. You know, he's in the ocean. His kids are around, but we've seen that before, Chris. We've seen that story before. Yeah, I'm happy doing this, but I'm not sure. Steve would have to come in. He's not going to be an owner, so he's not going to, well, I don't know. He's got money, but I don't think he's going to be an owner. So he's always going to have to answer to somebody. But I think if Steve came back, it would probably not be under Robert. I liked Robert Sarver during that time. I was doing the book. He was an interesting character. I feel incredibly bad for that organization, and particularly one of our favorites, Julie Fye, you know, the great public relations director who's been around for a long time. So I hope they would come back. Steve certainly has the skill. He certainly has the talent. The temperament would be something else. I mean, I'm not sure that Steve could ride, you know, with all the ups and downs that come with that job, because at this point, to come into the Western Conference, and if your goal is, gee, we're going to try to make the playoffs in 5 years, boy, that's a long mountain to climb. And my best guess is that Steve right now is just going to see his kids at least get through high school. But that's just a guess.
Right. Well, Jack, the book is terrific. Golden Days, West Lakers, Steph's Warriors, and the California Dreamers who reinvented basketball. It's available now everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you name it. You can go get it. Congratulations, Jack. Another terrific book, and thanks for joining me here on the podcast.
Had a great time, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
He hasn't really distinguished himself.
Chris is in desperate need of validation.
I think your opinion is shared by everyone.
So please, subscribe, like, comment.
I would punch him. That's just my opinion.
At your earliest convenience in the iTunes store.